I must say that getting the Pioneer Award was a lot more fun than I suppose it was for Mr. Gates when he got the Pie in Face Award at about the same time. So I have some requests for you. First, if you take a photo of me, please do not put it in Facebook. Facebook is a monstrous surveillance engine. It does surveillance on its useds, that is, the people it uses, and it does surveillance on everyone else on the net. Facebook uses face recognition. So if you put the photo of somebody into Facebook, you give Facebook one more way, one more opportunity to track that person. It's a bad way to treat your friends, and don't do it to me. Second, if you want to make a recording of the talk and then distribute copy, oh, here's the second box.
All right.
So if you take photos of me, don't put them in Facebook or Instagram, please. Second, if you make a recording and you want to distribute copies, I'm talking about audio or video, please do so exclusively in formats that are favorable to free software. That means the OGG formats or the WebM format. Not in MP anything, please, because those formats are patented in some countries. Not in Flash, above all, not in Flash. It's very bad for a website to use Flash, and you should complain if you ever see that. And not in Windows Media Player, Real Player, or QuickTime. QuickTime is bad because it's associated with iTunes. iTunes is extremely nasty because access to iTunes requires running Apple's non-free software, so you should never distribute anything in iTunes. No one should. And then, please make sure that the distribution site, in normal use by visiting the site with a web browser, lets users download copies of the recordings you're distributing without running any non-free software, in particular without any non-free JavaScript software sent by the site itself. This is what makes YouTube a bad place to use. YouTube distributes WebM format, which is a good format. But in order to play it through natural, normal use of the site, you have to run non-free JavaScript code sent by the site. And this is true for other sites as well. You better check the one you want to use. And finally, please put on the recordings the Creative Commons No Derivatives license, because this is a presentation of my point of view. So, what is free software? It means libre, not gratis. It means eléctero. It's eléctero logismico, because it is software that respects users' freedom. Well, what is a program and what is a computer? Well, a computer is a machine that does one simple thing. It gets the next instruction and obeys the instruction. And then it does it again. It gets the next instruction and obeys that one. And then it gets the next instruction, as you can see. And the instructions come from the program. Does this help at all? I don't know if it helps or just distracts. In any case, and it's so faint, can you see this red dot? The program is a series of instructions. With the right instructions, you can make the same computer do lots of different things. It'll do just about anything, with a few exceptions. So, who gives the instructions to your computer? You may think it's you, but really, it's somebody else. You may think the computer is obeying you, when really, it obeys someone else first and listens to you only to the extent that someone else is willing. So with software, there are two possibilities. Either the users control the program or the program controls the users. There's no other way. When the users control the program, we call it free software. Because, first of all, what is freedom? Freedom is having control of your own life, control of the activities that you do in your life. And so if you use a program to do the activities, freedom requires that you have control of that program. So, for users to have control of the program, that's necessary for the user's freedom. But in order for them to have control of the program, they need four specific freedoms regarding that program. Those freedoms give the users control. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish for any purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to change the program and make it run the way you wish. Specifically, it means the freedom to study the program's source code and change it so the program does your computing activities the way you wish. Now, what is source code? Well, programmers write a program like this in a language that looks somewhat like math and has recognizable words in it. So if you know programming, you can read this and you can understand what this is going to do. To run it, you convert it into an executable, which is a bunch of ones and zeros that are very hard to figure out, even for somebody who's an expert in the field. It's a monumental job to understand what a large program does in executable form. So in order for users to have, in practice, the possibility of changing the software, they've got to get the source code. But note that freedom one is the freedom to change it for yourself. So you're free to change your copy, and I'm free to change my copy. But I can't change your copy, and you can't change my copy. Here we see one user who is exercising freedom one, and then three other users that are using the program unchanged. They're all free to do that. But most people are not programmers, and if you give them source code, they've never learned to figure out what that means. So if all they have are freedom zero and one, they don't have any control. So we need collective control, which means that users can work together to change the program to do what they want it to do. Here we see a group of three users that are working together. Two of them are programmers, and they're actually changing the program. And the third one, apparently, is not changing that program. Maybe he's not a programmer, but they're all discussing together about what to do. So in this way, the non-programmer participates in controlling what this program is going to do. Meanwhile, there are other users that don't participate in this group. They're free to do that. Collective control means that each user is free to work with others collectively to control what the program does. And that requires two more essential freedoms. Freedom two is the freedom to make exact copies and then give or sell them to others when you wish. And freedom three is to make copies of your modified versions and give or sell them to others when you wish. With those two freedoms, the people in a group are free to work together. Because group members can change the program, then distribute their versions to others in the group, who can then make more changes or merge them together or test them. And they are also free to make their version available to others, even to release it to the public. Now, freedom two is especially important morally, because it includes the freedom to share. Sharing is a specific activity. It means non-commercial redistribution of exact copies. So that's a much narrower, freedom to share is much narrower than free software's freedom. It's one specific thing you can do. But it has special moral importance, because when people are forbidden to share, someone is attacking social solidarity. Anyone that forbids people to share is explicitly dividing them. And if you accept, if you make a promise to somebody that you won't share a program with other people, that is a betrayal on your part of your community. So you should never make such an agreement. I never have. But if you did make such an agreement, you should not make it even worse by obeying the agreement. You know, it's bad enough to agree to promise to do something wrong. But if you actually go through with it, that's even worse. So, this does not mean that it's a good thing to distribute unauthorized copies of proprietary software. Those programs are evil because they are proprietary. An unauthorized copy of a proprietary program is almost as bad as an authorized copy. It's not bad because it's unauthorized. No, that makes it a little less bad. But it's still bad because it's because this program doesn't give people the four freedoms. So, if we have those four freedoms, then the program is free software. The users control the program. But if one of these freedoms is missing or insufficient, then the users don't control the program, which means the program controls the users and the developer controls the program. So this proprietary program is an instrument giving the developer power over those users. Every non-free program creates a system of unjust power. Non-free software is evil and should not exist. This is the basic idea of the free software movement. Every non-free program in the world is a wrong. It's an injustice. They shouldn't exist at all. Now, when the developer has power over the users this way, nowadays the developer knows it. The developers are aware of their power and they're constantly looking for ways to take advantage of that power to gain more power over the users through the program. They put in malicious functionalities. So what do? They track people. For instance, the iThings have something called iBeacon, and stores installed things to track the beacon so they could see where the users, the victims of iThings went in the store. And the Amazon swindle transmits messages to Amazon with the name of the book and what page is being read. So it's surveilled reading. This ought to be a crime, by the way. Both of these ought to be a crime. The people who do these, who make such systems and run them should be in prison. But they're not. They get worse than just spying on people. Sometimes they are designed to stop the users from doing things. This is known as DRM, Digital Restrictions Management. The perpetrators of these, so for instance, this is a horrible blue ray which shoots at users when they try to copy the data on the disk. And many users have made the mistake of getting a disk with a Blu-ray, and then if they try to copy that disk, well, it doesn't actually shoot them, it just stops them. No one has been able to make free software to copy the data on those disks. Which means we should never use them, because we must never accept devices designed to stop us from doing things. The perpetrators of these malicious functionalities say that DRM means digital rights management. That term is biased in favor of them. We must not repeat the enemy's propaganda, so we should never say that DRM means digital rights management. From our point of view, it's digital restrictions management. So let's call it that. If we are compelled to describe these in a way that favors our enemies or favors us, let's favor us, the victims that they intend to restrict this way. Now, this is one example, but DRM is found in lots of products. Now, sometimes they get even worse. There are back doors in products that accept commands to do bad things to the user. Here's the Amazon swindle again. It has a back door for remote erasure of books. Amazon can delete any book whenever it wishes. We found out about this in 2009 when Amazon remotely erased thousands of copies of 1984 by George Orwell. In other words, it was an Orwellian act in two senses. Now, sometimes they impose censorship. This is an I thing, and we refer to these products as jails because they're designed so that you can't choose which software to install. In fact, Apple was the pioneer in imposing censorship of apps. The system was designed so that users could only install apps approved by Apple. When the users found ways to defeat the censorship, they called it jailbreaking, meaning that they themselves recognized that this computer was designed as a jail for its users. Sometimes they sabotage the products through proprietary software. For instance, the PlayStation 3 was sold with two modes of operation. One was to play games using the gaming network. The other was install another operating system, GNU/Linux is the one that people usually installed. Then somebody figured out a way to break the DRM by running programs on GNU/Linux, or so Sony decided to get rid of that functionality retroactively. So they changed the protocol of the gaming network to make it break. Then they released a firmware downgrade, which took away the feature of running GNU/Linux or any other system, but worked with the modified gaming network. And then they told every user, you're going to have to lose one half of the functionality or the other. Take your choice. Install the downgrade and you lose this half. Don't install the downgrade and you lose this half. They should be in prison for that. By the way, later somebody found a way to jailbreak the PlayStation 3 and Sony sent the police after him, which is why we have a boycott of Sony. See boycottsony.org. Sabotage gets even worse. Some proprietary programs have a universal backdoor, which means a backdoor for remote imposition of changes in the software. Windows has a universal backdoor, so Microsoft can forcibly change the software of Windows in any way at all, remotely. Thus, Windows is not just malware, it's universal malware. Any malicious functionality that is not in Windows today can be remotely installed tomorrow. Windows also has spy functionalities, DRM, and in Windows 8, they introduced censorship. The Amazon swindle also has a universal backdoor, and Android has something that's more or less a universal backdoor, because Google can force the installation or deinstallation of any app at any time. Meanwhile, I should mention that Apple's operating systems are malware. macOS has DRM and spy functionalities. The iThings, I already mentioned that they have censorship of apps. They also have spy functionalities, DRM, and a backdoor. And there's another kind of sabotage that proprietary developers can do. This doesn't depend on any particular malicious functionality, but Microsoft shows the bugs in Windows to the U.S. National Security Agency before fixing them, thus giving the U.S. government a chance to use them to attack other people's computers. So what do you think of the use of Windows in the Greek government? It threatens national security, especially when it's used in agencies that are critical. So basically, using proprietary software is being the victim of malware. It's being dragged behind the bus along the street of your computing. And it's malware is so common. I could give you lots more examples. If you want to see them, look at gnu.org/proprietary. Basically, proprietary software is computing for suckers. And why do they do this? It's not that they're sadists. They're not just mad for power. No, they make money this way. The more users they can subjugate, the more money they can get at those users' expense. So don't be the sucker. And they have no shame about this. They don't even feel a need to deny this anymore. They have events where they give talks about how they're subjugating users and taking advantage of them. Essentially, in the proprietary software world, there's no ethics anymore about how to treat the users. It's purely a matter of how can they put a nice face on it so that people don't hate them. People would hate them if they knew. But they convince people through using the media not to think about how they're being mistreated or to underestimate how they're being mistreated. And then they try to make it sound like this is okay. They find some point where they can say you agreed to it. They say, if you don't want to be mistreated, don't use our products, but the competitors all do it the same. I don't think any of those things are an excuse for malware. So how do you escape? You come to the free world. We built the free world. We built it with the GNU operating system, together with Linux, the kernel. In 1984, I started developing the GNU operating system. I wanted to make it possible to use a computer and have freedom. That was impossible. The computer needs an operating system. In 1983, all the operating systems for new computers were proprietary. So if you bought a computer, in order to make it work, you had to have an operating system installed, and it was proprietary, so it took away your freedom. But I was an operating system developer, which meant I had a way to fix that. All I had to do was write another operating system. Then, as the author, I could legally make it free software. Then, everyone could use computers in freedom by running my system. In other words, I had a way to save people from the injustice of proprietary software, which most people didn't recognize as an injustice. I had the skills necessary to try to save people, to give them a way to escape, and it looked like nobody would do this if not me. That meant I had been elected by circumstances to do this work. It was my duty. It's as if you see somebody drowning and you know how to swim, and there's no one else around, and it's not Bush or Merkel, then it's your moral duty to save this person. Well, perhaps that statement is too strong. Perhaps we could identify some other people about whom I should not make the statement that you'd have a moral duty to save them. Like Bush's torturers, and people such as Obama that protect Bush's torturers, and not to mention some Greek generals, if any of them are still alive, and I don't know. Fortunately, I don't have to resolve these questions because I don't know how to swim. But in the real occasion in my life, the work to be done was not swimming. It was writing lots of software, and I knew how to do that. So I decided to develop an operating system that would be entirely made of free software. Every piece has to be free software. Because if you have something like an operating system that's a collection of many programs, in order for the whole collection to respect your freedom, each piece must respect your freedom. If there's one piece that is proprietary software, that takes away the user's freedom. So the whole collection takes away the user's freedom if it has the one proprietary piece. So then I decided to ask other people to help write it to get it done sooner. Then I decided to make a Unix-like system as a technical decision. Unix was an operating system that was proprietary, but it had technical advantages and was popular. So we couldn't use Unix and have freedom. Unix was not a solution. But if I made another system with the same technical advances, with the same, if I followed the design of Unix, I'd have the same technical advances. And if I made compatible commands, the users of Unix could easily switch to my system. So I decided to do that. Then I gave it a name which is a joke. The system has to have a name that's a joke. Even for the most serious purpose in the computing field, which is to give the users freedom, still you've got to have jokes. The name of the system is GNU, G-N-U, which is a recursive acronym that means GNU's not Unix. That was the customary way in such a situation to give credit to the other system that you're making something more or less compatible with. But in order to be a joke, it needs two meanings. The recursive acronym is one meaning. That's not enough. Why GNU instead of ANU, FNU, or SNU? Because those are not words. GNU is a word. It's the name of this animal that lives in Africa. And this is an adorable GNU that needs a home. So, two meanings. It's a joke, but it's better than that. You see, GNU is the most humor-charged word in the English language because according to the dictionary, the G is silent. and that looks very funny. And it leads to, and it means that the word in some pronunciations sounds like the word new. So every time you want to write the word new, instead of writing N-E-W, you can write G-N-U and you've got a joke. Perhaps not a very good joke, but there are lots of them. So we've learned to associate this word with laughter, making it the perfect name for any programming project. But when it's the name of our system, please do not follow the dictionary. Because if you say, let's run the new system, well, you're mistaken. We've been working on it for 31 years now, so it's not new anymore. And we've been running it for 23 years. So please pronounce the G hard. Please pronounce it GNU. That's the correct pronunciation, GNU. There's another error that you need to avoid, which is calling the system Linux. This system is not Linux. Linux is one component in the system as we use it today. It was the last missing essential component. In 1992, GNU was almost complete. We had almost everything necessary for an initial Unix-like system. But one major essential component, the kernel, was still missing. And in 1992, Mr. Torvalds freed his proprietary kernel, Linux. Linux was proprietary in 1991. In 92, he made it free software, which meant that Linux could fill the last gap in GNU, producing the GNU plus Linux system. That was the first free operating system that you could run on a PC, the first free operating system since many years before. Unfortunately, although GNU slash Linux is basically a free operating system, that doesn't mean it's entirely free software in practice, because people working on variants of GNU slash Linux often add non-free programs because they don't value freedom themselves, you see. Maybe this program is a convenient application that does a job there is no free software for. Well, that means a person's values start to matter. It's not just a technical question of how to make the system better anymore. The question is, what's important, convenience or freedom? I'm sure this program provides some convenience or they wouldn't think of adding it. But you have to decide, will you sacrifice your freedom? Will you lead other people to sacrifice their freedom for convenience? When you install GNU slash Linux, typically you get a distribution. Distributions are variants of the system designed to facilitate installation. And there are over 1,000 distributions. Most of them contain some non-free software. A few of them are entirely free software. These are the ethical distributions, the ones designed to respect users' freedom. The people who develop these distributions are people who care about freedom, and the people who develop the other distributions obviously don't care very much. You could tell from the choices they made. They chose to sacrifice freedom for more success or more convenience. We face threats to our freedom in other ways too. As you browse the web, web servers may send non-free JavaScript programs to your browser, and they run silently in the browser. And you don't know, because the browser doesn't tell you. So if you don't want to let web servers run non-free software on your computer, we developed Libre.js. That's an add-on for Firefox that analyzes all the JavaScript code to see if it's either trivial or free. In those cases, it permits the JavaScript code to run. But when a program is non-trivial and non-free, Libre.js blocks it and informs you on the screen. It does one other thing. It looks at the pages of the site heuristically to find where and how to complain to the webmasters. So, if you've ever tried complaining to the webmasters of a site, you know that the hardest part that takes the most time is finding where and how to send your complaint. Libre.js does that for you, so it makes complaining quick and easy. Please complain. In 10 minutes a day, you could complain to 10 different sites' webmasters, and that will be helping our cause. You can get Libre.js most easily by installing our browser, IceCat. IceCat, obviously, is a variant of Firefox, which is free software, because we got rid of the name and the logo of Firefox. And it has many modifications to protect users' privacy, and it has Libre.js. Another way you can lose your freedom in computing by losing control of your own computing activities is if you entrust those computing activities to somebody else's server. This is known as service as a software substitute. What it means is that your computing is done in some company's server. Now, this says Google, but that's just an example. Lots of other companies are doing the same thing, and it doesn't matter which company it is. The problem is the same. The problem is that if you let somebody else's server do your computing activity, then that company controls it and you don't. It's equivalent to running a non-free program. If you run a non-free program in your own computer, you don't control what it does. If instead you send all the pertinent data to the server and it does your computing, you still don't control what it does. So SaaS, or service as a software substitute, is equivalent by the structure of the scenario to running a non-free program. But it's even worse. I explained many non-free programs have spy functionalities. They send data to somebody's server. Well, with SaaS, you have to send all the pertinent data to the server. Same result. The server has your data and will show it to Big Brother, I suppose. And then I told you that some proprietary programs have a universal backdoor, which allows the developer to remotely change the software, forcibly remotely change the software, and thus change how the user's computing is done without asking the user's permission to change it. Well, with SaaS, the server operator can, of course, install different software in that server, and should be free to do so. It's their computer. They should be free to change the software in it. But when they do so, because it's being used for SaaS, the effect is to change how the user's computing is done without asking the user for permission to change it. So SaaS is equivalent to running a proprietary program with a universal backdoor and spy functionality. So it's equivalent to proprietary malware. And the only way to protect yourself is don't do SaaS. So for instance, I will never use translation services because they're SaaS. If you have a text that you want translated, that computing is yours and purely yours. It's nobody else's business. And to prove this, use a thought experiment. Suppose you had a giant computer, the most powerful supercomputer in the world, and you had exactly the right software. Could you do the computing activity in your own computer? If you could, then it's your own computing. What are the things you couldn't do in your own supercomputer with the right software? You couldn't communicate with others because they're not in your computer. They're not using your computer. They have their own supercomputers in this thought experiment. So the things that you can't do inside your own computer, it's because they involve other people. Well, that involves communicating through the network one way or another. And you can't have total control over an activity that involves others. You shouldn't. So the issue of SAS doesn't apply to these joint activities, communication with others. It applies to your own computing. So we deserve freedom in our computing, but how are we going to get it? Well, the free software movement is campaigning to advance all the time. But what are the obstacles? Well, the companies that have subjugated users make a lot of money from this. They don't want to let go, and they're going to use their money to stop us, to work against freedom. So we should protest them at every opportunity. If Apple ever sends someone here to recruit or to sell anything, you should protest. Chase them away. And not just Apple, that's one example. I see somebody has a Macintosh, but I hope you've installed GNU/Linux on it. You can do that, you know.
Not yet, but I will.
Good. Another obstacle is open source. In the free software movement campaigns for freedom for users of computing. This is an ethical issue, a moral issue. It's an issue of right and wrong, good and evil. And we present it that way. We say proprietary software is an injustice. Well, during the 1990s, there were people in the free software community who didn't agree with that idea. They really participated in the community, but they had different ideas. And so there was a debate about this. But in 1998, the people who didn't agree with the free software movement coined the term open source so that they could talk about the same software, avoiding moral questions. They didn't want to raise the political question of whether users deserve freedom. With their new term open source that had not been used before, they had a chance to construct a different discourse. They could choose which ideas to mention and which ideas to forget. They decided to forget the entire ethical foundation of the free software movement. They presented the issue as merely a matter of development methods, of choices that developers could make for their own selfish reasons. So where we say the right value is freedom for users, and we want freedom, we reject proprietary software, they only say it's a technically better way to develop software. They say it will result in better code quality. We say, if you develop and distribute a program, you are morally obliged to respect the user's freedom to modify and redistribute that program. The open source people say, if you develop and distribute a program, you might find it in your practical interest to let users modify and redistribute the program because then they will improve the code quality. So the difference between free software and open source is at the deepest possible level, the level of values. For us, freedom and community for the users, for them, code quality. The reason, of course, that they reject our ideas of freedom is that's too shocking for them. because we are saying that a commonly used business model is wrong and should be stopped. And they, above all, want to bow down to business and get the support of business, so they don't dare say anything that might disturb executives of businesses. The problem is that they were the majority, and they had the support of most of the businesses in the free software community, because most of those businesses were not ethical. They developed some free software and lots of proprietary software as well. So they wanted our ideas to be hushed up. So the journalists followed the businesses, and so did the politicians in most countries. And as a result, in English language, mainstream media, and some other languages as well, you hardly ever see the term free software. All you see is open source. When they mention my name, they associate me with open source. If people have heard of me, they think I'm an open source supporter. So imagine if you were a Syriza activist, and every time they wrote about you, they associated you with PASO. It would defeat everything you do. So I've even seen articles that called me the father of open source. I send a letter to the editor saying, if I'm the father of open source, it was conceived through artificial insemination using stolen sperm without my knowledge or consent. Then I explain about what the free software movement is and our values and our principles. That's the real practical, that's the serious purpose of the letter. But I start with a joke because I like jokes, and anyway, a joke might convince them to publish the letter. The real purpose of the letter is to explain about free software, explain the ideas that were missing from the article. So I do everything I can to spread these ideas. It was in 1998 that I started spending most of my time traveling, giving speeches, where I spread the ideas of free software, because they don't spread when they're covered up by open source. So we need your help in this. Don't say open source, especially when other people are saying open source. That's the time that you can help the most, by saying Eleftheros Logismiko, because then you can show people that there's a moral issue here, a political issue of freedom, that's more important than the convenience things that those open source discussions are raise. I can't do this all. I'm doing everything I can, and it's not enough. We need you. If you want to become a free software speaker, that would be a very useful thing to do. Another obstacle is hardware whose specifications are secret. So they sell you the product and they won't tell you how to use it. Instead, they say, here's a proprietary program, run it and shut up. What do we do about that? We can't write free software to run that hardware if we don't know how you run that hardware. Sometimes we can convince a company to cooperate. That's the ideal solution. But if not, then we need reverse engineering. Somebody has to study the executable and write down the specs of that hardware. And then someone else can write free software to run that hardware. Now, we need to teach. Another obstacle is that most schools are teaching proprietary software. Now, this should be illegal, because this is against the social mission of education, which is to educate good citizens of a society that is strong, capable, independent, cooperating, and free. So schools should teach free software. And they should teach the ideals of freedom to explain why they teach free software, so that they can graduate people who are ready to be good citizens of such a society, people who are accustomed to free software and ready to be free software users. Of course, proprietary companies, they want to give out proprietary software to students in school the same way that tobacco companies want to give cigarettes to students and children, to get them addicted. Schools must refuse to be used in this way. But there's also the issue of moral education in citizenship. Schools must teach the spirit of goodwill, the habit of helping others. Therefore, every class must have this rule. Students, if you bring software to class, you may not keep it for yourself. You must share copies with the rest of the class, including the source code, in case someone wants to learn, because this class is a place for sharing our knowledge, not withholding it from others. So it's not permitted to bring a proprietary program to this class, except for reverse engineering. The school, to set a good example, must follow its own rule. It must bring only free software to class and share copies, including source, with everyone in the class that wants them, except for reverse engineering exercises. But there is also the matter of education, which is what schools are supposed to be for. A proprietary program or a free program embody knowledge. Every program embodies knowledge. If the program is proprietary, that knowledge is withheld from the students. If they ask, because they're fascinated with programming and they want to learn, they ask, how does it do this? If it is proprietary, the teacher can only say, we're not allowed to know. It's a secret. But if the program is free, the student can read that and learn. So the teacher can say, well, here's what I know, and if you want to learn more, here's a copy of the source code for each of you. Read it, and you'll understand everything about this program. And those kids, we're assuming that they are the kids who are fascinated with programming and they want to learn, they will read it because that's the way to find out what they want to know. And the teacher can say, if you come across a point in the code you can't figure out by yourself, show it to me and we'll figure it out together. This gives our talented programmer a chance to learn something about writing good code. Namely, that's not good code. If you're talented and you can't figure it out, it's because it's badly written. So how do you advance from being a talented programmer to being a good programmer? That means learning to write good, clear code. You have to learn what is good, clear code. And the way you learn it is the hard way. Every time you read some code and it's hard to figure out what it does, you learn. You think, how could I avoid making my code hard to understand like this? To learn to write good, clear code, you have to read lots of code and write lots of code. Only free software gives you the chance to read the code of large programs that we really use. Then you have to write lots of code. To learn to write code for large programs, you have to start small, which means not writing small programs. That's not even a start at dealing with the challenges of large programs. No, starting small means writing small changes in existing large programs. And then you can advance to bigger and bigger changes. Only free software gives you the chance to write changes in existing large programs we really use. So any school can give students the chance to master the craft of programming if it is a free software school. a non-free program, because it is knowledge concealed from the students, is the enemy of the spirit of education. So it should never be tolerated in a school except for reverse engineering. Now, universities should teach reverse engineering. This is a very important skill. There are too few people who do it. So few that they are in tremendous demand. You can make a lot of money that way. So that's a second reason why universities should teach reverse engineering. But also because it's necessary to advance our freedom. Now, each new area of life brings with it additional human rights that a free society depends on. And these human rights depend on each other. If one stone is pulled out of this arch, it collapses. What that is meant to explain is that when we lose one human right, that impedes our attempts to defend the others. Now that computing is so important in society, free software, that is, control of our own computing, has become one of the human rights we need in order to defend the others. We've got to get rid of proprietary software from our society. So this may require sacrifices. Of course, sometimes defending freedom requires a big sacrifice. Fortunately, in this area, the sacrifices tend to be small ones, like you can't do that particular thing that would be fun, but you'd be giving up your freedom. So think what's important and say no. So how can you advance our cause? First of all, look at gnu.org/help, and you'll see that you can do it if you're a programmer by writing free software. If you're not a programmer, you can organize to promote the use of free software. You can push for schools to move to free software. This university and every other school should get rid of proprietary software. And if you have a relationship with a school, it's your duty to campaign for the school to move to free software. If you're a parent of young children, well, they're going to go to school. Their school should not teach them dependence on proprietary software, so you better start pressuring that school to stop. And governments should move to free software. You do computing for your own pleasure, just like every other individual. But governments don't do computing for their own pleasure. Governments don't exist for themselves. They exist to do things for the people. And whenever a government agency does computing, it's doing that computing for the people. So it has a responsibility to the people to maintain full control of that computing, which includes doing it with free software and rejecting SaaS. So every time there's a proprietary program in a government agency, that is failure to carry out the state's responsibility to the people. They've got to fix that problem. Of course, it takes time to convert a university to free software, and it's going to take even longer to convert the whole state. Some cases are quick to convert, some take longer. Of course, this is true. But they've got to start working steadily out at the job so that it will get done. You can also help other users. For instance, you can organize a GNU/Linux user group, which is a group that helps people learn to use the system, installs it for them, and so on. And just by saying free software instead of open source, you're helping our cause. Just by saying GNU/Linux, rather than make the mistake of calling the system Linux, you're helping our cause. Here's why. Linux was developed by a person who's in the open source camp. He doesn't believe that you deserve control of your computing. He doesn't believe he should have control of his own computing. He says he's happy to use proprietary software as long as it's convenient and reliable. He doesn't think in these ethical terms. And he has a right to his views. But when people erroneously attribute our work to him, which is what they do when they call the system Linux, they give him a very big platform. When people admire him for our work, they tend to listen to him instead of us. And what is it they don't listen to? We're constantly saying, your freedom is what's at stake here. Think about what this non-free software is taking away from you, not just the convenience it gives you. Join with us, fight for freedom, and we'll replace this proprietary software with free software. That's what we say. But if they attribute the work we have achieved based on these ideals to somebody who rejects them, then they're going to listen to him instead. And you see this happening all the time. People saying, I'm not going to listen to you GNU fanatics. I'm a Linux user. And when they say that they're Linux users, they mean they're using the GNU system. But they find excuses to deny that. A series of fallacies they can use. It's well developed, of course, these excuses, to believe that he deserves the credit and not us for our work, and thus excuse the fact that they listen to him and ignore their own freedom. And that has real consequences in terms of making freedom insecure for all of us. So look at gnu.org/help, and you'll see more ways to help our cause. In gnu.org/distros, you can see information about the various distros of GNU/Linux, like which ones are free and which ones are non-free. The widely used distros are non-free. And sad to say, the most influential distro, Ubuntu, is non-free. So don't recommend that. Why is this a serious problem? Well, one reason is, if people decide to install GNU/Linux, most people will recommend a non-free distro, because that's what most people use, some non-free distro. And so the problem propagates. Because it's big, it gets bigger. And this leads those people to install a variant of GNU/Linux, yes, but it will include some non-free software and they won't know it. But there's a worse problem from the non-free distros, which is because people are so aware of them, they have a lot of influence on shaping people's ideas. What they communicate influences people, and what do they communicate? They could say, you deserve freedom in your computing and you won't get it from us. They could, but of course they don't, because then they'd be making themselves look bad. So instead they say, we try to give you the best possible user experience. How do you teach people values? By referring to those values implicitly in what you say and what you do. So their statements implicitly say, value convenience, not your freedom. And that has a lot of influence. It leads a lot of people to become open source supporters. Of course, those distros all say open source. They don't talk about free software and freedom. These problems all go together. For information on free software licenses, look at gnu.org/licenses. In license-list.html, you can see a long list of licenses and which ones are free and which ones are non-free. Of the free ones, it will say which ones have problems, which don't. Free licenses are basically divided into two categories. There are the copyleft licenses and the weak licenses. Some of them we call pushover licenses. In order to be a free license, it has to give every user the four freedoms, and all these licenses do so. The difference is copyleft licenses place a condition on freedoms 2 and 3. Remember, freedom 0 is to run the program as you wish for any purpose. Freedom 1 is the freedom to study the source code and change it so the program does your computing the way you wish. Freedom 2 is to make exact copies and give or sell them to others when you wish. And freedom 3 is to make copies of modified versions and give or sell them to others when you wish. Copyleft places a condition on freedoms 2 and 3, saying when you redistribute copies, with or without modifications, you must do so under the same license and providing source code, and basically you must pass along the same freedoms to the other people that you got from us. The idea of copyleft is to make the four freedoms inalienable rights that all users must get. Because if you use a non-copyleft license, a weak license, those licenses don't have the copyleft condition, which means they permit making others to make and distribute proprietary versions. Which means most of the users of those programs may not get freedom at all. You've heard, I'm sure, of the Apache web server. That's free software released under a pushover license. You've probably heard that some large fraction of web servers run it. What you may not have heard is that many of those are running IBM's proprietary modified version. And they got the code of Apache, but they didn't get freedom. This is what happens if you don't copyleft your code. For recommendations on choosing a license for your work, look at gnu.org/licenses/license-recommendations.html. For many philosophical issues, look at gnu.org/philosophy. There are dozens of articles there about various issues. And there's gnu.org/GNU for the history of GNU and the issue of the system's name. There's also fsf.org, where you can find the Free Software Foundation and its campaigns, information on resources for free software. Other ways you can help our cause: we would like to have an active Greek translation team for GNU.org, but we don't. If you want to volunteer to help launch this translation team, write to webmasters@GNU.org. You can also join the FSF through fsf.org, or if you prefer to pay your dues in cash, since I'm here, you have an opportunity to do so. There is also the Free Software Foundation of Europe at fsfe.org, which you can also join. 20 years ago, the Free Software Foundation used its funds to develop free software. But nowadays, there's so much free software development going on that we couldn't add very much with the funds we have. So we work on other things, campaigns against the things that threaten our community. So, now it's time for the auction. This is an adorable GNU that needs a home. So I'm going to auction it for the benefit of the Free Software Foundation. If you buy it, I can sign the card for you. If you have a penguin at home, you need to get a GNU for your penguin. Because as we know, a penguin can't hardly function without a gnu. There should never be a penguin without a gnu. We can accept payment in cash or with a bank card if it can make international payments by phone, or with Bitcoin if you have something here to make the payment with. I'll be answering questions for quite a while, so you'll have time to go to a bank machine and bring money back. When you bid, please wave your arm as big as you can and shout the amount. Don't wait for me to see you before you shout. That's backwards. Shout immediately so I'll look at you. And you need to shout because I have hearing problems. If you require me to have coordinates, I'm right now. And I'll start with the standard price, which is 20 euros. Do I get 20 euros for this adorable gnu? 20 euros? I've got 20 euros. Do I get 25 euros for this adorable gnu? 25 euros to the Free Software Foundation to defend freedom? It's still a great bargain.
25.
I've got 25. Do I get 30?
30.
I've got 30. Do I get 35?
Yes, you do.
I've got 35. Do I get 40? I've got 35 euros. Do I get 40 euros for this adorable gnu? 40 euros to the Free Software Foundation to defend freedom. How much? I've got 40. Do I get 45? How much?
45.
I got 45. Do I get 50? This is getting to be fun. Do I get 50? 50 euros? For this adorable gnu, 50 euros to defend freedom. Do I get 50 euros? Last chance to bid 50. Oh, I've got 50. I've got 50. Do I get 55? I've got 50. Do I get 55 euros for this adorable gnu? 55 euros to the Free Software Foundation. Do I get 55 or more? Last chance to bid 55 or more. Last chance going.
60.
I've got 60. I've got 60. Do I get 65 or more? 65 or more for this adorable gnu. 65 or more to defend freedom. Last chance to bid 65 or more. Last chance. Going. Going. Gone for 60. Please come up and pay. By the way, we still have stickers here. You can take as many stickers as you can put to good use. If you can use 20 stickers, take 20 stickers. So here is your gnu. I'll sign it after the questions. And we're still selling buttons. The little buttons are 1.50 euro, and the big buttons are 3 euros. We also have metallic stickers. Like this one, they say GNU/Linux inside. We make them in metal so that they're durable. They're 1.50 euro. And the table is up there. So now it's time for questions. I still have hearing problems, just as I always do. So you need to speak loud, slowly, and clearly. You need to pronounce each consonant carefully so I can recognize it. My problem is recognizing consonants. So, do we have a microphone for the questioners?
No.
We had a hard time finding one for you.
Oh, Okay, well, you'll have to come down here, make a queue to ask questions so you can be close to me. If you want have a question, come down here and make a line. Well, if there are no questions, I don't insist. I'd be happy to leave early. But if you have any questions, I'd like to answer them. Come down. No, no, don't stand up. Don't sit up there and try to speak to me.
I'll pick up. So, I understand the ethics of collecting information from users while they don't want to do this. But the bottom line is somebody should pay the bill.
No.
So,
the bottom line is...
So, what do you suggest the job of a programmer is in order to make money and make a living?
First of all, that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is to have computing that isn't evil. If the project is going to be evil, it should not be done. That's the crucial thing, to make sure that evil software is not developed. Developing proprietary software is an attempt to subjugate people. It is not a contribution to society, it's a power grab. It's digital colonization. So, the non-free program operates as a trap. If it has attractive features, those are the bait. Their purpose is to attract people to sacrifice their freedom becoming users of that program. So, paradoxically, the better the features are, the more harmful the program is to society. Therefore, if you have the choice to participate in developing proprietary software or do nothing, you ought to do nothing, because at least that way you don't do any harm. Of course, in actual life, you probably have other choices which are better than both of these, so use them. But don't develop proprietary software. That's inexcusable, like being a corrupt politician. I can just imagine a politician saying, well, ultimately, what pays the bills? If you don't think I should be corrupt, tell me how I can make just as much money some other way. And the answer is, no, you must not be a corrupt politician. There's no excuse for that. And if you want to make more money than you can get being a non-corrupt politician, quit politics and do something else. It's the same with software. There's no excuse for proprietary software. But in fact, there are lots of people getting paid to develop free software. And they get paid in various ways. Sometimes companies that make their money in another way fund the development of free software. Governments do that too. After all, a large fraction of the world's software development is funded by governments, and they can always make it free software, and they should. But in addition, there are small companies that develop computing solutions, and some bigger ones that also develop computing solutions for clients. Now, the clients who want a special purpose solution are always going to have to pay for the development. But if the clients are not suckers, they will insist that they get it as free software, and they should also insist that it be able to run on a free platform. And this way, the job of developing it is ethical. You just have to make sure of one thing, that the client is not planning to turn it into proprietary software to release to others, because that would be evil. But if you deliver it under a copyleft license, then the client will be able to release it as free software, but will not be able to release it as proprietary software. Of course, just by looking at what the job is, you can usually tell. And if you see that the job is one that they're going to run internally, then there's no problem. Then there are others that develop and release free programs and sell support to users. There are various other free software business models too. It's an interesting issue. It's not my main focus, but by all means, look for free software work. But if you can't find free software work, that doesn't excuse proprietary software. You're not entitled to say, I'm going to make money through programming by hook or by crook, and if that means subjugating people, then I'll subjugate people. That is the attitude of a monster. Other questions?
I want to ask you, you've been around since the beginning of interfering with computers. I have a question about the users. Right now the users...
Could you explain what you mean by interfering with computers? Because I can see multiple possible meanings for that.
When people starting to use computers in daily life.
Oh.
That's the reason you developed the GNU.
Actually, no. In 1983, when I decided to develop the GNU system, it was computers were used by professionals and some hobbyists. They were not part of most people's daily lives until the 1990s. But nonetheless, I was a user of computers, and I wanted to have freedom, and most of my acquaintances were users of, were professional users of computers. I wanted them to have freedom.
Okay. So nowadays we can see users, billion users using Facebook knowing that they are monitoring. Billion users using Gmail, Dropbox, me, myself.
Well, you see, they construct social pressure for people to do these things. And the current, the social current that they create sweeps along people who don't resist. Now, I resist all of those things. I have never used Dropbox, because to use Dropbox requires non-free software. It's even worse than the question of what the Dropbox servers will do to you. It's at the first step, you have to run non-free JavaScript code, so I won't. However, I'm trying to find somebody to develop a free front end to run to use Dropbox. Now, there are some purposes for which it would be okay to use Dropbox if only you could do so without non-free software.
But eventually, these past 25 years, the users have been using mostly...
They've been mostly proprietary software. The malicious services have developed in the past 15 years, and especially in the past 10 years.
Yes, and we have seen the users mostly use services such as Facebook.
Yes, I know. Okay, what's the question?
The question is the moral battle is lost.
No. Well, things are going pretty badly. You could think of it as, say, just after Thermopylae. Yes. We have, on the other hand, we're getting stronger in other dimensions all the time. We have a lot of capable free software. You can do a lot of things with our free software. But what it takes is organizing socially against non-free software and against surveillance services. We need the strength to say no. And then we have to organize at the government level to forbid their malicious practices. You see, massive surveillance of the type we have today is incompatible with democracy. We are subject to more surveillance than the inhabitants of the former Soviet Union. Not because they didn't try, but because technology limited the amount of surveillance they could do. Nowadays, it's feasible to track the movements and communications of nearly everybody. Stalin would have loved to give everybody in the Soviet Union a mobile phone. A mobile phone constantly reports where the person is, and it can be converted because it has a universal back door. It can be converted remotely into a listening device, which listens to all the conversation in the room and transmits it all the time. And not only that, you can't turn it off. Because once they get converted in this way, they pretend to turn off, but they actually keep running and listening and transmitting. The only way to stop them is to remove the batteries, all the batteries, including the small secondary battery that some models have, which can't be removed except by desoldering it. Some models don't allow removing any battery. I wonder why. Basically, due to the proprietary software, a mobile phone is Stalin's dream. So, that's why I refuse to carry one. I'll use other people's mobile phones to converse with, because that way Big Brother doesn't find out that it's me. So, we have to, the first step is refuse to use these systems, even if other people are pressuring us to. And the second step is organize to demand redesign of digital systems so that they do not accumulate a dossier about people who are not court-designated criminal suspects. You see, with the level of surveillance that exists today, the government can tell who talks with whom. And that is terribly dangerous, because it's dangerous to democracy. Democracy means that the people control what the state does. But states tend to do things secretly that the people can't control. How do we find out about those things? We find out with the help of heroes, whistleblowers. But the state calls them criminals and puts them in prison. If the state can identify them, it will punish them. So how can we make it safe to be a whistleblower? We have to reduce the level of general massive surveillance below what it was in the Soviet Union, and even further below, to the point where the state can't identify whistleblowers, can't find dissidents. So, we must have laws to require the redesign of digital systems so that they do not create dossiers about people in general, so that they can be used anonymously, so you can make an account for communication without indicating who you are. Twitter used to permit this. Now it's ruined. So for more information about this, look at gnu.org/philosophy/surveillance-vs-democracy.html. Next question.
If you change just a few words from your discourse, I think you could apply everything that you're saying in other sectors of society.
No, you couldn't. System. No, you couldn't. It's but in
say,
any case,
let,
you...
Yeah, let me say what, yeah. I mean that what you're discussing is also happening at the same time in food, in art...
No, not the same. It's not the same. There are occasional similarities, but if you think it is simply a matter that the powerful control others, the thing is, yes, that's common to many areas, but the details are very different. We can't change our food in the way we can change programs.
We can't.
Genetic engineering is not that advanced. Yes, we do. Breeding new varieties of plants or animals is a long, slow process that's sometimes possible and sometimes not.
It's controlled right now. Food production is controlled by a few, and we could...
Yes, but that's... You see, you're ignoring most of what I said, and you're keeping just a tiny little skeleton of it. And yes, that you find in other areas.
I'm saying we can have free food, for example. What I want to say is that what you're discussing is part of a systemic issue.
I disagree.
You think that...
I disagree. These
issues
are not the same.
So you, my question is, you think we can have exactly the same system politically, economically, and socially? And
same as what? I don't know what you mean. You think we could have the same system politically and economically? I don't know what that means. Economics is one thing and politics is another.
I don't think it's another. I think it's exactly the same.
What's another? You're not being clear. You're too vague in every sentence.
So you're not listening. So I'm asking, do you think that we can keep the political system as it is right now, the economic system as it is right now, and still develop free software and make it popular and put aside...
We're already doing so. However, the existing political system is plutocracy, and that's an injustice. So for other reasons, mainly about other fields where injustice is happening, we must eliminate plutocracy, we must defeat the power of the banksters, but that's not a matter, but the thing is that what's happening in those other fields is other kinds of injustice, and they're not the same as the injustice in software. If you simplify everything to the point where they look the same, you're missing everything important in each of these fields, and you can't do anything effective to solve the problems. Because what needs to be done in software is specific. It's not enough to get rid of plutocracy. That wouldn't make all software free. There was proprietary software in the 1970s when... And that's when proprietary software took over the field. And none of those companies was so big then. None of them had particular power over governments then. But they subjugated users. So, yes, plutocracy, which is a general injustice, has a relationship with proprietary software. And today, because some proprietary software companies are big, they have power over states. But it's a mistake to try to understand the issue of proprietary software as simply plutocracy at work. It's not simply that. So you're trying to simplify the world too much. Plutocracy is one injustice and proprietary software is another injustice. And yes, because they both exist, they've established relationships. But if you identify them, if you don't understand how that they're different and have a relationship, if you treat them as the same thing, you won't understand. A lot of technical people have a tremendous desire to make everything as abstract and general as possible, and that's a recipe for not understanding.
So, in other words, it's a small developer, so like one person maybe, would have a customer who orders a...
It depends.
Software, isn't it?
That depends. That's one scenario and not the only one.
And that would be not plutocratic at all, of course.
Well, wait, right. When it's a small company is not an instance of plutocracy.
Right.
It's an instance of capitalism, which is not the same as plutocracy.
Sure.
But... On the other hand, that company's business may be good or evil. It depends on what the company does.
Well, now, on the course of this development, the company owner says, okay, I can deliver that software to the customer.
So are you assuming that the company... Wait. I want you to make explicit what you're assuming. Are you assuming that this is a company that develops solutions for clients to use?
For a particular client?
Okay. Now it's a clear scenario, because small companies that develop software might be developing proprietary apps.
Sure. Sure.
That happens too. And now what we understand what scenario.
And the scenario is this. The small company which delivers a toxin for one client, but for general distribution, could still decide to deliver the software in a proprietary way.
It could, and that would be wrong.
Just an executable.
Right, that's mistreating the client.
So what does the client have to do in terms of support from the FSF? This is a real question.
I don't understand. Support, that's support from the FSF. I don't understand what kind of support that client might want.
About that. The Greek government, for example, often contracts software written.
Yes.
However, there is not enough know-how in the people in the government who do the
So they need training.
And they need training.
Yes, they need to get that from the Greek free software community. The FSF, which has a staff of 12 if there are no vacancies, is not in a position to do this training. We don't do that.
No, not
that. But there are people in the community who do it.
Do you have a knowledge of other communities, other countries, other...
There are lots of free software.
For people who order software made for them?
In Europe, there are many companies that will develop free software to order.
Oh, sure.
And there are also lots of people who are good at using free software who can train someone. There are organizations that systematically do trainings.
But if you are by law forced to take the lowest bidder...
No, the point is, you don't understand. You don't understand. The law should say all solutions funded by the state must be delivered as free software, and they must be developed so that they are portable and can run on a free platform. Otherwise, the developer cannot be paid. It should be illegal to pay the developer if these criteria have not been met. The choice of the state's sovereignty or surrender should not be decided by who's charging less. The restoration of the computational sovereignty of the Greek state must be a priority of law.
But what can be done at the level of below the parliament, below the lawmaking?
I don't know.
What can be done at
May, I don't know. But I'd say the best chance now is to do it in parliament.
Oh, now?
Yeah.
Well, okay, maybe not.
Well, there's a chance. They're interested.
There's
so,
a positive attitude. I don't know.
Yes, well, look, take it. Look. You can either find excuses to say it's hopeless and give up, or you can seize the opportunity and try to win. You have got to try to win.
I'll tell you what the problem is.
I'm not interested now. Talk to me later, okay?
Actually,
this is a minor detail.
This is a question. The Greek, it just occurred to me. The Greek government supposed that it is willing to pass a law. I'm pretty sure that that law is against the European Union rule.
I don't think so. In any case,
that would be
Greece should ignore them anyway. Basically, Greece should say no. Greece should say that if we can't get full control of the software, we won't accept it.
There is a lot of software which is very special purpose. To give an example in card work, which is my field, FPGA software, so you can do place and route and what can
yes.
specific technologies.
That's actually, I don't know what you mean by special purpose. That's exactly as special purpose as a C compiler.
Well,
a C compiler produces output to run on a computer. The FPGA tools produce output to run on an FPGA. It's exact, the special purposeness of both is equal.
But the scale is different because you have dozens.
What's the question?
Okay, can there be free software of the complexity of
how complex is it? What makes you think it's complex? It's proprietary, we don't know. But people in the 80s would have asked, could there be free software of the complexity of a C compiler? And I proved the answer is yes. And now it's a lot more complex, that C compiler. Basically, we've written very complicated free software. It's a matter of getting the people to do it, and in some cases, it's a matter of reverse engineering. In the case you mentioned, reverse engineering is needed.
But reverse engineering in this case would solve one specific instance. Part of the problem is that with these products...
Yeah, it's the same as you have to learn... A C compiler has to know about each CPU architecture. It's exactly the same situation.
If you make a backend, you can port it easily, right?
Well, no. I had to work hard on making a backend that was portable. But the point is, you still need to know the specs of the hardware you're trying to support.
So you think that it is feasible to have that kind of complexity with free
software? It is feasible, but it's not easy to get it done because it's a substantial amount of work. This is one reason why the university should teach reverse engineering.
Well, if we don't have any more questions...
Oh, actually, we do. What?
Sorry.
There is a... When comparing the proprietary...
You need to pronounce the consonants more clearly, each and every one. So I can hear each and every consonant.
So, when comparing proprietary systems with free software, we see that there's the majority of people following the proprietary software, and then there's the free software with the added, and I put into quotes, obstacle of respecting the freedom of users. So my question is this. Will free software ever be able to antagonize the proprietary systems that don't respect freedom?
What do you mean by antagonize? I don't understand.
I mean building free systems.
Do you think we could ever defeat proprietary software?
I mean providing the same or alternative services.
It's just a matter of work.
Yeah, but as you said in your presentation, when putting someone's data into another, into a server...
Yes, that's a different issue. That's not the free software issue. The servers raise ethical issues that are different from the ethical issue of free versus proprietary software.
When we send our data into a server, then we lose our freedom.
That's right. So I don't give data to those servers.
So what would be an alternative to services such as cloud computing?
First of all, cloud computing is not a thing. Cloud computing is an extremely vague term which clouds your mind. Because it is so vague, there is nothing meaningful you can say using the concept, quote, cloud computing, unquote, because it's too vague. You can't replace something vague. You can only replace specific things. In fact, it's a mistake to say that cloud computing is either good or bad because it's so many different things, and some of them are okay and some of them have problems. You can't think about it at that level of vagueness. So that's the only thing to know about the term, quote, cloud computing, unquote, is it's too vague for serious thought. You should never use that term. But in any case, there are services which can be done in a different way so that they don't know who's dealing with them. For instance, Anything that distributes copies of something. All we need for that is digital cash that you can pay the site with, and then it could operate anonymously and you pay for each thing you want. Well, we're working on that. We have a project called GNU Taler. That's T-A-L-E-R. If you look at gnu.org/software/Taler, you can find information about it. It's a kind of digital cash designed for making anonymous payments to websites, but it's designed so that the website can't use it for tax evasion.
What is your opinion about Bitcoin?
Bitcoin solved one problem, namely that payments companies could exclude activities. For instance, the major payment companies blocked donations to WikiLeaks. And that showed that society was vulnerable to their centralization. WikiLeaks solves that problem. They can't block payments to... Sorry, Bitcoin solves that problem. They can't block Bitcoin payments to particular recipients. However, Bitcoin is not anonymous. That's why GNU Taler will be in advance. Well, there's free software to use Bitcoin, so there's no real problem in that area. Any other questions now? Okay.
Okay. About hardware, a large debate in free software and the open source communities is around binary blobs inside the Linux kernel.
Yes.
Especially in Debian, you mentioned in GNU distros, that the bad thing about them, among others, is that they contained up to version 6.0.
Well, actually, wait, not so. Debian got rid of the blobs from its copy of Linux. Yeah, well, that's good.
That's
not a problem with today's Debian. The issue with Debian is something else. So the point is, don't bring up these two separate issues. Bring up one at a time, please.
What I'm talking about is about hardware vendor lock-in. Most of the vast majority of hardware that is in production today contains proprietary stuff that disallows...
Listen. No, you're mixing up different issues. I can't discuss these several different issues if they're lumped together. I have to separate them, please.
Okay.
Please, listen. Some pieces of hardware contain firmware. That's one issue. Another issue is when the hardware doesn't contain firmware, but you have to install the firmware and it's proprietary. Our position is it is totally unacceptable for the hardware to require you to have firmware installed in your system that is non-free to load into the hardware when you start the machine. So we reject that. That's non-free software in your system, in your operating system. The other issue where the hardware has some firmware in it that we don't even necessarily know about, you can't do anything about that. In fact, you can't even tell it's there. And that means at some level it ceases to make a difference. Does it matter whether this chip has some firmware in it or just physical circuitry? Maybe it's no difference. In which, if you can't tell, it makes no difference. Note that either of them could be malicious. So in that issue too, it makes no difference. So at present, our position is we pay no attention to firmware that's buried in hardware that users don't touch. You can ignore that distinction, And as for the danger of malware, well, either one could be malware. So once again, it doesn't matter whether it's malicious software or malicious hardware. Now, when we can fabricate our own chips, we will need to demand free chip designs. We will need to insist on using only free design chips and fabricating them ourselves. But technology hasn't reached the point yet where that's possible. So for the moment, it would be silly and ineffective and pointless to demand that. But we should start working on these free designs so that we don't have to start from zero. And if a CPU is made from a free design, there are some advantages. Even if they're mass produced, you may be able, somebody could use a microscope and verify that the chip actually matches the design, and it only has to be done by one group once, as long as they, and then they can just every so often open up a chip from the new batch and make sure it matches the others.
You're talking about hardware. Is there a corresponding set of freedoms that you have formulated like the four ones?
Listen. It's not hardware, it's the hardware designs. The hardware designs can have the same four freedoms, and then they're free designs. At the moment, it doesn't make sense to reject hardware made from non-free designs. But in the future, if we can fabricate our own chips, then we will insist on free designs to fabricate them from.
Designs are software, they have no...
Exactly. Well, they're not exactly software, but they are works. And because they're works, it makes sense that I believe that all works of practical use, that is, works that you can use to do a job, ought to be free. That means with the same four freedoms. That today includes textbooks, or more generally, any kind of teaching works. It includes reference works. It includes typefaces for formatting paragraphs of text. It includes 3D printer patterns for objects that are useful, not just decorative. It includes recipes for cooking. All these things should be free. And when we can use chip designs to make chips, chip designs should be free too.
Could you think of unclean distributions of GNU Linux or software like Wine as an intermediary step to free software so you could do more good job than bad?
In theory, they could be intermediate steps towards freedom. The problem is that they discourage people from taking the next step. You see, suppose here's the goal and here you are. If you can go over here, the question is there a path from here to here, or is the path actually this way? And the next question is, once you go here, does this encourage you to take the next step, or does it encourage you to stay where you are? The problem is that the non-free distros, they don't present themselves as an intermediate step. They present themselves as the endpoint. They don't say to you, this distro is inadequate because there's non-free software in it. Please help us get rid of that. They say the opposite. So their actual effect is to discourage people from wanting to take another step. And that means for society know they are not an intermediate step, at least not left to themselves. It's, if we want them to become an intermediate step towards freedom, we've got a tremendous job to do. And I'm trying to do it, of course, by spreading these ideas. And you can do it too. In the 1990s, lots of people suggested to me, let's take a two-step approach. First, let's get people using free software. Then, let's teach them about freedom. And every time they said this to me, they presented it as an excuse for them to focus on the first step. So we had lots and lots of people focusing on the first step and hardly anybody working with me on the second step. Well, that's not the way to get both steps done. That's the way to get the buffer to fill up in between step one and step two. And the result was there were lots of people that were using some free software and knew nothing about the ideas of freedom, which meant that most of our community didn't think of freedom, which meant that most people wouldn't learn about freedom because everyone they talked to was only thinking about convenience. It's time to stop now. So, happy hacking. And now I will sign the GNU.
Thank you very much.
You can still take some stickers, and you can still buy buttons and metal stickers up there. Now, I'm in a hurry, so I'm going to be leaving as quickly as possible. So, I'll have to be here for a few minutes, but that's all.